Ms. Chigurin. Would you like to reserve some rebuttal time?
No, Your Honor. Good morning to the Honorable Court. I'm Sharon Chigurin here on behalf of Timothy Amos. He is here in the courtroom today. So imagine your worst nightmare. You've been divorced from your spouse since 1994. You work for 22 more years for the railroad, and you know that as part of your divorce decree that the court has awarded what he thought to be legally at one-third of the railroad pension to the spouse. So when he plans to retire, trying to do the right thing, he takes the final decree of divorce to the railroad board, only to find that his former spouse under the order is entitled to more than monthly retirement than he was because of the transposition of the numerator and the denominator, in addition to which she is likewise entitled to the amount that was earned from the date that they separated until date of entry of a final decree of divorce. Obviously, the numerator and denominator transposition, very little question of clerical error, that it was a clerical error, and it was corrected by agreement with Ms. Amos, the plaintiff's lawyer. So that's where we have the problem, is with the 12-plus months after separation that this order says that she's entitled to one-third of the pension. So when one gets divorced and their assets at issue, there are two ways that the court can go. They can go, if the parties reach an agreement under 20-109, then the court implements the agreement that they reach. If not, then the court goes with Virginia Code Section 20-107.3, which is the equitable distribution statute. In this case, by the language of the final decree, the court engaged in equitable distribution under 20-107.3. It's really an either-or proposition. Virginia Code Section 20-107.3 makes clear then and now the language of the statute is exactly the same in that regard, that you can't award a portion of the pension that is earned after date of separation.
Well, the parties could agree otherwise, though.
The parties can agree otherwise, but very clearly under this order, it wasn't an agreement of the parties.
Let me put it to you this way and see if you can answer this question. It seems to me that under the peculiar circumstances of this case, the court only had jurisdiction to correct clerical errors.
Yes.
And there was an agreement that the numerator-denominator reversal was a clerical error, and so no problem. But there was no agreement with respect to the other issue. And it seems to me, although the court didn't expressly say so, it did allude to the fact that there have been some agreements, some unspecified agreements made, and it simply couldn't determine, in the absence of an agreement, what the agreement of the parties was. And so didn't disturb the original, in other words, it couldn't relitigate the issue of equitable distribution in this particular context. It could only correct a clerical error. And if there's no agreement that's a clerical error, and if there's no clear written agreement as part of the separation agreement or property distribution agreement as to what's going to occur, how could the court say one way or the other that it is or is not a clerical error that it can correct?
Well, if it's not a clerical error, then it's an illegal and void order, and that's the problem. I think that the law favors trying to give a proper interpretation
let me stop you. Please explain to me how it is an illegal order.
If the court orders something that the statute doesn't allow, then that's a void order.
It may be voidable, but you're saying that's illegal?
Perhaps not the right use of the word. What I'm saying is that the court has ordered something that it doesn't have jurisdiction to order. The code section authorizes the court to divide the pension under 20-107.3, which the decree clearly says that that is the proceeding that the court is going down, that it can order the division of it during the time that the parties were married and before their last separation. And so if the court does something more than that in this final decree, which is what the court was looking at and trying to determine if there were clerical error, if it's not clerical error, then it's an order that where the court has exceeded its jurisdiction in ordering something that statutorily it didn't have the authority or jurisdiction to do. So the obvious conclusion is either it's an order that the court didn't have jurisdiction or authority to make that determination or that division, or it's a clerical error. It seems pretty obvious that they're both clerical errors.
Because the third option, it seems to me, and the third option is that there was an agreement between the parties that extended beyond what the statutory limitation was.
Except that is not evidenced in the final decree of divorce. What is evidenced in the final decree of divorce, and that's the clear problem here, is the court, in determining it wasn't a clerical error, said, oh, there was a mention in that final decree that there had been agreements of the parties. Well, that is not evidenced in the order. That court, if you look at that final decree of divorce, it's very clear that it wasn't an agreement. The court specifically said that... The court specifically said that it was after consideration of the factors, here it is, that after having maturely considered the factors set out in 20-107.3 as they pertain to equitable distribution, that it awards a portion of the defendant's retirement. It's taking the road of equitable distribution, not agreement under 20-109. There is no evidence in that order at all that there was any agreement, and especially when the court was making equitable distribution of the assets. So
well,
that's where...
Counsel.
Yes, ma'am.
If you look on the first page of the agreement, under the second paragraph, of course, it indicates that there were statements made concerning the issues as well as agreements, and the parties presented evidence and stipulations. So
and
that
that's
would lead one to think that there were certain things that were stipulated to and or there were certain agreements.
But there weren't agreements under 20-107.3. That's the paragraph bringing on the cause that says that there were certain agreements, and this final decree covers custody, visitation, child support, spousal support. There's no designation in any of those that they were not agreed provisions, but when it gets to 20-107.3 to equitable distribution, the court takes that fork in the road and makes a finding that it has maturely considered the factors set out in 20-107.3 and makes equitable distribution. So when it makes equitable distribution, it cannot put in anything that is in violation of the equitable distribution statute, and there is no mention in the division of the assets that any of that was that the division of the pension was an agreement or there was any agreement as to that.
Well, again, I get back to, I think, my first question, which and this, I think, is picks up on Judge Chafin's question as well. This divorce decree was entered back in 1994.
Yes, sir.
And it specifically says what it says, which, although reversing the numerator and denominator, says it's divided by the number of years, quote, during which the parties were married. Nobody objected to that at the time, apparently. There was nobody said, hey, that's not right. You know, it's not what we agreed to. It's not consistent with the statute. Nobody did any of that. Now you come along and the court no longer has jurisdiction in the absence of a change in circumstances to do anything other than to correct clerical errors. And the assertion is this is a clerical error. No evidence is presented to at least in the record that I can discern other than it conflicts with the statute. But the fact that it conflicts with the statute doesn't necessarily mean the parties that didn't agree to it, as they agreed on the numerator and denominator issue. So, I mean, how do we say the court is wrong in not correcting a clerical error when there's no evidence that it was, in fact, a clerical error?
Then the only other option is that it's a void order.
It's a voidable order.
Voidable order, yes, sir.
But if nobody voided it at the time,
it didn't have to.
Then it has legal effect, does it not?
No, sir. I think that you can come back now and say that this is
I don't think that word means what you think it means. I mean, voidable means you've got to exercise your authority to void it in a timely manner, not when the property's already been distributed.
Well, I don't think the property had been distributed because he hadn't retired. He didn't retire until, and that was when the error was found. But it still is pretty obvious from the case law that this was a clerical error. It wasn't an agreement. There is no evidence at all that this was an agreement. The order is either wrong or right, and the order, if it is a voidable order, then it's a voidable order, or there's a clerical mistake. And the interpretation towards clerical error makes much more sense than the interpretation towards a voidable order. The court clearly wouldn't have set out to do something it didn't have jurisdiction to do. And that's what it did when it divided the asset the way it did, the railroad pension. And so the only logical way to be consonant with what the court intended is to say that there was a clerical error in there. And I think that it's bolstered by the transposition of the numerator and the denominator. There was at least one clear mistake there, and this is just as clear. And I think it bolsters the transposition of the numerator and the denominator bolsters the logical conclusion that this is a clerical error. And clerical errors can be corrected at any time. Mr. Amos is not seeking to say that it's a voidable order. He wants to be consonant with what the court ruled, and he can come back at any time and say there was a mistake. It was a clerical error. Clearly, the court didn't intend to violate the statute, or not follow the statute, or exceed its jurisdiction. So we need to correct the order such that it comports with the code section, the language of which is clear and has been clear and was clear at the time that the final decree was entered. So that would be our position with regard to clerical error. I won't repeat my analysis of cases addressing correction of clerical errors, but I think that you can discern from those that there is an interpretation for the court to make and seeking to try to find out what was accurate and what would make this final decree comport with what the requirements of the statute are. As to the arguments raised in the appellee's brief, it doesn't matter whether the bill of complaint was introduced into evidence as to the date of separation. The final decree entered on October 26th of 1994, addressing a hearing on September 2nd of 1994, made a finding that the parties had been separated for more than a year and the divorce was granted on the basis of a one-year separation. We didn't introduce a copy of the 1994 version of 20-107.3, just as with case law. The statute is there, and it reads the way it does. We don't have to introduce the statute in evidence to show that that's what the statute was at the time. With regard to no evidence introduced that he continued to work for the railroad after date of separation to entry of a final decree, that in no way affects what this order says. The fact is that the railroad board takes the order and makes the calculation. If he didn't continue to work subsequent to the separation of the parties, then why have we got the formula that has the that initially had the numerator and denominator transposed? That makes no logical sense and doesn't go with what their other contention is. So for those reasons, we request that the court reverse and remand the matter back to the circuit court for correction of the clerical error in paragraph 4 on page 5. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gallenbach.
Morning, judges.
I'm Robert Gallenbeck. I represent the appellee Mary Lou Amos, now Campbell, in this matter. For the most part, I'm going to stand on my brief in this case. I do have a few things I would like to point out for the court. First, in order to avoid a really bad position in the circuit court, the appellant has not asked the court to void the order of the circuit court, and we'd ask the court not to even consider voiding the order, so we have to go back and retry this case. Second, with regard to the transposition, that was a mere transposition of the words numerator and denominator. But here you've got the judge's actual words where the judge says date of divorce rather than date of separation. I think that makes a huge difference.
Well, let me interrupt you. Does the court have authority to do that in the absence of an agreement between the parties?
I do not believe that the court would have the authority to do that in the absence of an agreement of the parties. However, if that was the case, then the case should have been appealed back in the 1990s. It shouldn't. Basically, the appellant is asking for an appeal today of a decision made at that time, not really asking for the correction of a clerical error, because this says on page one that there were agreements of the parties. One thing I'd like to correct is my second assignment of error, where I said a husband is entitled to attorney's fees. I meant to say that the wife is entitled to attorney's fees, and that's corrected at page 8. The appellee did procedurally default in three areas. However, as to the first, I apologize for citing Duckett, because the law was changed subsequent to Duckett. And with regard to all of those procedural defaults, I don't know how the court will consider them, but I will admit that we were not prejudiced by them. Now, there are 5 points dealing with the facts of the case. First, as I've already said, if this was not an agreement of the parties, then it was appealable at the time, and it should have been appealed at the time. Second, the husband states that because the decree says that the court considered the factors of equitable distribution, because the court said it adjudged and ordered an equitable distribution, does not mean there was not an agreement. I know that's a double negative, but I think the court knows what I'm getting at. First of all, the court, right after that, approves an agreed division of proceeds from the sale of the house. This court doesn't know how much the house sold for, how they were divided, but the court goes on and affirms that division, so it affirmed an agreement there. Second of all, it affirms the agreement of the division of personal property. So it does show that the court did ratify certain agreements of the parties. Second, the husband says that we know that the date of the separation because of the bill of complaint. Well, we don't, because it was never introduced into evidence. The trial court was never asked to take notice of the statute in 1994. I think that's a question the court will have to consider, but the court will recall that in cases, for instance, involving DWI seconds, the court could consider, for instance, a North Carolina conviction, but you have to ask the court to take judicial notice of what that law was in North Carolina. And I think the court would have to take judicial notice. I don't think you have to introduce it, but I think you have to ask the court to take judicial notice of what the law was at that particular time. Finally, and I think this is probably my most important argument, we ask you to look at Jacobs versus Jacobs, 218 Virginia 264, 1977 case, 268 and 269, where it says, where one party to a legal controversy has within his control evidence material to the issue and does not produce it, there is a strong presumption that such evidence, if produced, would operate to his prejudice. This so-called presumption arises from the failure to produce real or documentary evidence, the failure to call a material witness, or the party's own failure to take the witness stand, or as a witness to answer questions when he possesses material knowledge. It may arise also from the failure to produce evidence which though not in hand, is readily available. If there was no agreement, then the husband could have taken the witness stand in this case and said there was no agreement. We never agreed to that. There's a strong presumption by failure to call him that his evidence would be contrary to his best interest in this case. And there was no evidence taken in this case. And the burden was on the appellant in this case. And the burden, again, is on the appellant here because there's a presumption that the order of the court below is correct. And once again, we believe that the wife is entitled to attorney's fees. In the absence of any questions, I forfeit the rest of my time.
I have any questions. Thank you, Mr. Gallenbach. We will come down and greet counsel. Thank you.